for a cat. That was all he said. No, he said he doesn't like Cheerios anymore. Then he said he wanted to wear different shoes than the ones I could find, and then, when he had me on the ropes about the shoes, he suddenly zigged and mentioned the cat. He could hear her smile. Are we going to get him one? Maybe. Maybe when you come home. A pause. Or maybe if I don't. You will. Okay. Bill heard voices in the background. Hey, Adelaide just showed up. I gotta go.
Busy day.
She sighed. Same old, same old.
Will you be able to Skype tonight? Lucas loved you reading to him last night.
I don't know. I'll text you, okay?
I love you.
I love you more.
I love you most.
He heard her smile again, and then she hung up. Lally and Lucas had apparently been hooked up to a sugar IV during the last hour of preschool, which seemed unlikely but was empirically indicated. Both of them were in that state of little kid laughter where at any moment one of them might throw up. Frances watched them in the rearview mirror, torn between letting them laugh because, you know, children, and trying to calm them down so they didn't implode. It was unclear why they were laughing, but apparently that shit was comedy gold. They were also amused by the enormous amounts of toilet paper and paper towels on the floor of the minivan. Mama went to Costco. Of course, by the time they pulled up in front of Francis's house, they were pale and angry with each other, and only the immediate application of an episode of Blue's Clues, Classic Steve, on Netflix, and some goldfish crackers settled the waters. As she made them lunch, Frances answered in her head for Blue, and wished she had a handy-dandy notebook. This world, the world of the preschooler, was where she felt most comfortable these days. After going through this phase twice before, she knew resistance was futile, and Mommy ninja'd her way through most of the challenges Lally threw at her. With a 14-year-old, a 10-year-old, and a 4-year-old, Frances finally felt she had some kind of paradigm for understanding her experience of parenthood. Raising kids was like warfare. Not in the dramatic death of millions kind of way, obviously, but in the struggle for peace kind of way. Babies and little kids were like trench warfare. It was physically exhausting, psychologically draining, and there was a lot of flying mud and screaming. Shit went everywhere. Your clothes were ruined. You ate when you could, slept when you could, and got interrupted at the whim of the enemy. Elementary-age kids were like campaign warfare. You knew there would be times of stress, like forcing a child to get a shot at the doctor or to do their homework, or to give up on the concept of becoming a Pokemon trainer in the real world. But in between those intense sessions, there was a lot of boring routine. One minute it would seem as though you were making progress, with promising overtures on both sides. But then 2 minutes later, someone chucked a grenade and everything caught fire. The big change, however, was what happened when the hormones kicked in. Then it was a guerrilla war against an unseen counterinsurgency. Everything seemed much calmer on the surface, but any minute an improvised explosive device could cut you off at the knees, or a sniper could get you in the back of the neck. You could never fully relax, and there was a lot of tiptoeing about and quizzing other kids for intel. Sighing, Frances filled 3 little bowls with mac and cheese and joined Lally and Lucas on the sofa. She watched Steve do his thing and continued her inner debate about how salt and pepper could have managed to conceive and produce both paprika and cinnamon. Salt was a crystal. Pepper was a seed pod from a plant. Paprika was also a seed pod. Okay, so yes, she could see that, but cinnamon was the inner bark of a tree. She had wondered this before, which is why she had Wikipedia'd all that stuff and had, in fact, a fairly high level of knowledge about the international pepper trade as a result. It still bothered her, and she worried that Mrs. Pepper was a little tough on paprika, especially once the baby came. Ava was angry, and Frances had no idea why. She had no way of knowing if her daughter was angry with her, or with someone else, or just furious at the world in general. Not that it mattered. Ava often came boiling out of school ready to fight, as if she'd been simmering ever since drop-off, and had planned everything she needed to say for convincing victory and the ultimate vanquishing of the adult world. But then she just sat there, letting her silence shout at her mother instead. Could anyone emanate silence as forcefully as a 14-year-old? No wonder people associate poltergeist activity with adolescence. They can beat you around the head without raising a finger. Frances felt a headache starting and took a deep, cleansing breath and slowly let it out. "Why are you sighing at me?" Frances shot her daughter a look. "I wasn't. I was just breathing." "Well, quit it." "Completely?" There was a pause. "No," replied Ava. "Not completely. I'm not tall enough to reach the pedals from over here. And if we crash on the way home, I'm sure I'll get blamed." She picked at her nail polish. "Not to mention that you'd have to explain to Anne, Iris, Charlie, and Bill why their kids were all in the hospital." Ava relaxed a little. "Charlie and Bill would be fine, but Anne would be pissed. She's a little bit scary." "Anne?" Frances raised her eyebrows. Ava was looking out of the window. "Yeah. Sometimes she looks at me as if she wants to snap my neck and throw my body on the ground." Frances pulled to a stop at a red light and turned to Ava. "Really?" Ava nodded, but didn't elaborate, her mind already somewhere else. Frances looked in the rear view. Theo, Kate, Wyatt, and Milo were chattering away about God only knew what. And Lally and Lucas both had the thousand-yard stare of mid-afternoon preschoolers who were only a year or so out of taking a nap. None of them were paying any attention to her conversation at all. She tried to reel Ava back in. "How was school?" Ava shrugged. "Same, same." "Same, same good or same, same bad?" "Same, same repetitive, which I think is what the phrase same, same implies." Her edge was back, like the slightly raised shoulder fur of a dog. "I don't have to fight you," it said, "but I can and will if you keep irritating the shit out of me by merely existing." "Who wants to stop at the park?" Frances raised her voice, startling the littlest kids and interrupting the older ones. They all looked interested, so she started a detour toward the playground. "I have homework," said Ava firmly. "You need to drop me at home first." "We'll only stop for half an hour. It will be good for you to be outside for a little while."
"No,"
replied her daughter. "It won't. Don't tell me what I need. You have no idea what I need." She'd shifted herself away from her mother, each incremental inch making her distaste for proximity crystal clear. "I didn't. It will only be a half an hour, and I'll buy you ice cream." There was a pause as the Ava who loved ice cream fought with the Ava who hated to let her mother win. Milo suddenly spoke from behind them.
"If she has homework, maybe we should just go home. I don't really care about the park."
"Who are you, my agent?"
Ava's tone was scornful. Frances looked at her son's eyes in the rear view. This was a new dynamic she'd noticed. He hated when she and Ava argued, so he was starting to take Ava's side. But Ava rebuffed him every time, not needing anyone's backup, thank you very much. Least of all that of a little boy. The little boy in question turned quickly to look out of the window, the scythe of his sister's tone surprising him to tears. Frances felt the quick, sharp pain of empathy, which was always so complicated when the slight was between siblings. But she kept her tone mild.
"Ava, he was just trying to help. There's no need to be mean." "I don't need his help. I need to go home and be left alone to get on with my homework, and preferably my entire life."
She knew she just hurt her brother's feelings and felt bad about it.
But in the battle between her and her mother, he was collateral damage. Unfriendly, friendly fire. Frances felt a tightness at the base of her throat that meant she was getting annoyed. She pushed it down, turned into the playground parking lot, and pulled into a space, punching the open door button as soon as she turned off the engine. The younger kid started unbuckling, and she turned to her oldest child and smiled. "Look, Ava, I know you're a mass of hormones and conflicting chemicals, and I understand you have homework. But half an hour in the park will mean a better evening for all of us, and that's what we're doing. If you want to sit in the car and sulk, feel free." Ava started to speak, but Frances was already out of the car and helping the little ones jump down. As Milo climbed out, she gave him a quick hug and followed him to the playground, not looking back at Ava at all. Frances sat on the side of the playground where a low wall ran around the equipment. In theory, this playground was well-designed, with a large central play structure and the aforementioned wall going all the way around. It probably looked awesome in blue pencil on thin paper, printed out in a New York design practice. But in real life, it meant you could easily lose sight of your kids. All along the wall, parents would look up from their phones, scan the structure, then stand and crab walk along until they spotted their charge, sitting down again where they could see them, dropping their eyes back to their phones, and then repeating the whole dance several times. If you time-lapsed it from a drone, it would look like the shadows on a sundial, circumnavigating. Frances's kids were old enough that she'd stopped crab walking, but occasionally she would scan, pausing as she waited for one or the other of them to appear, or bend to look under the structure, hunting for their shoes. When she had other people's kids too, as now, she was more watchful. Losing her own child would be bad enough. Losing someone else's would be a disaster. Ava appeared next to her, ostentatiously carrying a textbook. She sat down, opening the book to a section on homeostasis, and did a little mime of running her finger down the page to the appropriate sentence. "So," said Frances, "homeostasis, eh?" "Yep," replied her daughter. "Maintaining balance, right?" "Yep." "A pendulum swinging will eventually come to rest in the middle?" Ava sighed. "That's not a perfect metaphor, because homeostasis is about balance between oppositional forces, which keep pushing. A pendulum rests because it's run out of energy to swing." Frances nodded. "Just checking. You wondered if you'd forgotten the meaning of homeostasis?" "No, just wondered if we were still talking." Ava smiled a very small smile. "Oh, we'll always be talking, Mom. I'll push from one side, you'll push from the other. You know." Frances put her arm around her daughter and gave her a squeeze. "I know you have homework, baby. But the littler kids need to run about a bit, okay?" Ava nodded. "I don't know why I get so cranky with you. I'm just so tired after school and so wound up from being nice all day." She laughed at herself. "Not that I'm all that nice at school, I must admit." Just then Lally appeared and tugged at her sister.
"Will you chase me?"
Ava started to frown, then suddenly nodded and got to her feet, turning to Frances. "Balance, right?" Frances nodded, watching Ava tear away after her little sister, who was instantly hysterical with delight. 6. Michael was satisfyingly appalled when Frances told him the news that evening.
"He was going down on her? Before 9 in the morning? Jesus!"
She nodded, not sure if it was the cheating or the earliness of the hour that bothered him. But then Lally came in. It was after dinner. She'd had her bath and was supposed to be brushing her teeth. To be fair, she did have a toothbrush in her hand.
"Do I have to brush my teeth?"
She sounded like she'd maybe identified a loophole in the toothbrushing law and was ready to exploit it.
"Yes, you do."
Frances was firm.
"What's up, Lal?"
Michael was sitting in the big comfy chair in their bedroom, his laptop open on his lap. Multitasking as usual, although the news about Anne had almost made him close his computer. The little girl turned to him and stuck out her arm.
There's a hair on my toothbrush.
She pulled out her new strategy.
It seems unsanitary.
You mean unsanitary?
She nodded, because that was what she'd said. Michael took the toothbrush from her, removed the hair, and handed it back.
It's fine now. Was it your hair?
She shrugged, turning to go, her tiny little form in elephant pajamas almost too cute to bear.
I think it might have been Jack's.
Jack was one of their dogs.
Was he using your brush?
Michael was joking, of course. The dog had his own brush, one of those items that mysteriously turned up in drawers whenever Frances was looking for something else, but which couldn't be found twice a year when she remembered you were supposed to brush the dog's teeth. In the same class were things like chargers for SLR cameras, passport photos you hadn't sent in with the application yet, kitchen implements used only at Thanksgiving, and those tiny screwdrivers for fixing eyeglasses. Frances dubbed the whole class occultatum, after the Latin word for hidden. This coinage made her feel slightly pretentious, but she enjoyed muttering it when she pulled open drawer after drawer, looking for something. Lally was losing interest.
No, but I think Milo was combing his hair with it. I'm not sure. Something.
Frances tried for clarification. Milo was combing his own hair or Jack's fur? Lally just shrugged again and wandered out. Frances turned to her husband.
Did you understand that?
He shrugged, just as his daughter had, and turned back to his screen. Then he remembered what they'd been talking about and looked up again.
No, really. Right there in the front room? Visible from the street?
Frances made a face.
No. They were on the floor, not hovering in midair.
The only reason I saw them was because I walked into the actual house.
For the toilet roll tubes?
Yes.
At first I thought it was Charlie.
Her husband laughed.
You thought Anne and Charlie were having interesting sex on the floor of their living room at 9 in the morning?
Frances pulled off her boots and started taking off her clothes. Okay, maybe that isn't very likely, but it is the first assumption you make when you see a married friend having sex on the floor.
Oh, I know that's what I think every time. Have you ever seen anyone else having sex on the floor? Is this what you get up to while I'm at work?
Frances pulled off her sweatshirt and bra, enjoying that first scratch of tit freedom. Then put on a large pair of flannel pajamas with dogs on them.
Yes,
she replied. I creep from house to house hunting for people having sex. Michael smiled.
We've been married nearly 20 years, and you haven't changed a bit.
He paused.
Are you going to blow the whistle?
Good Lord, no. Why would I do that? She looked at her toenails, which needed cutting.
I don't know. Because it's honest?
She looked at him and raised her eyebrows. You're joking, right? Why on earth would I do that? This other guy could be just a one-time thing. She reached into her bedside drawer, hunting for her nail clippers.
Like in a porn film? He was delivering a pizza?
She snorted. Yes, because Anne Porter has pizza for breakfast every day. No clippers, what a fucking shock.
Okay, he was delivering a brioche and a venti americano.
Jack and Diane, the dogs, came in and jumped on the bed. Frances shut the drawer and scooched back to make room for snuggling, wondering if Anne would have had an affair if she'd had a dog. I don't have the sexiest marriage in the world, she thought. But I get a lot of affection and approval from my dogs, with far less negative fallout. Maybe I should persuade her to drop the extracurricular sex and get a rescue dog instead. Then she thought about what Michael had said, and her mind wandered. Why don't they deliver more interesting things in porn movies? He didn't look up from his screen.
Because most people aren't focusing on what the setup is, you doofus. Oh, let's watch The Sears Guy Always Comes Twice. It's all about the exigencies of appliance repair. The way the director sets up the tensions and potential resolutions in the first 10 minutes is masterful, and the anal is all in one take.
Frances opened her mouth to reply when Ava walked in. Michael closed his computer. Frances noticed this every time. For her, he kept the screen open, just in case something more interesting popped up. But for his firstborn, he shut the screen without even thinking about it. She wasn't jealous. She was reassured every time she saw the pecking order in action. She would put the kids before him every time, and he knew it and would do the same. If he didn't take a bullet for the kids, he'd have to take one from Frances.
Why are you guys talking about anal? And can I get a phone?
Ava asked this question pretty much every day, but so far the answer had been no. However, she had clearly studied compound interest and thought maybe bugging worked the same way. A little every day would mount exponentially. And maybe she was right. Frances could feel herself weakening.
We weren't talking about anal, we were discussing film theory, and no, said Michael.
But, Frances interrupted her. Every kid in school has one but you. What if you get lost, even though you rarely leave the house alone? You'd be able to keep your calendar on it. You'd be able to take notes in class, even though your school doesn't allow phones in class. Yes, we've heard all your arguments, Ava. And sorry, but the answer is still no. You don't need one. They're expensive. And I want you to read books rather than spend all day gazing at a screen. You have a computer. That's enough.
Ava glared at her mother, as teenagers have glared at parents since Neolithic Mom first refused to get Neolithic Teen a new axe.
I hate you. You guys never go anywhere without your phones, but that doesn't count, right? You just want to keep me dependent, because then you have something to do to fill your empty days and pointless existence.
She turned on her heel, pretty smoothly, and stormed out. Frances looked at Michael.
That's a new approach.
He nodded.
It's got potential.
My days are hardly empty.
Frances was a little stung, but not badly.
And how does she know about anal?
She uses the internet, and don't get mad. She's full of hormones and squished on all sides by peer pressure. She'll apologize before she goes to sleep.
Frances nodded, because he was right, at least recently. Ava would pick a fight, or Frances would say something careless and Ava would get her back up, and suddenly they'd be bickering. Then, after a bit of shouting and stalking away, Ava would sit in her room and sulk for a while, then call to her mother in a wobbly voice and say she was sorry and that she didn't mean it. Frances would apologize, too. She'd also promised to herself that the next time Ava pushed her buttons, she'd bite her tongue, remembering only too well the driving desire to fight with her own mother at that age, the need to lash out and bang up against something. Then Ava would cling to her and cry, reassured that she'd never drive her mother away, that Frances would always be there to fight with, make up with, take for granted, and depend upon. Frances would smooth her daughter's hair, tucking the damp strands behind her ears, knowing that in another couple of years, Ava wouldn't care enough about her opinion to fight with her. The opposite of love isn't hate. It's indifference.
Michael was still on topic. So if you're not going to tell Charlie, why did you tell me? What if I feel obliged to tell Charlie?
He had reopened his laptop, Frances noticed.
You don't. You wouldn't.
Frances scratched Jack behind his ears, causing him to make that rumbly sound in his throat that made her smile.
No, but what if I did?
I thought about that before I told you. I decided the risk of you suddenly changing completely after 20 years was smaller than the risk of me suffering a panic attack because I was keeping a secret from you.
Diane had pushed Jack out of the way and was now all up in Frances's beak, demanding attention. Frances looked around her at Michael and smiled at him. He looked surprised.
You don't keep anything secret from me?
Apart from my exact weight and the location of my secret chocolate stash, no.
A different stash from the third drawer in the laundry room?
Shit.
I'm an idiot. Now you're going to move it.
Yes. Frances paused. Why? Do you keep lots of secrets?
Of course. Some on purpose, and others just because you wouldn't be interested. I'm not sure those even count as secrets.
He pushed down one of his socks and scratched his ankle.
I think we need to frontline the dogs again.
How do you know I wouldn't be interested? I have a very quiet life. Most things are interesting. Try me.
She pulled on Jack's long, soft ears gently. He let her. It was symbiotic. He let her pull on his long ears like a toddler with a baby blanket, and she fed him and told him he was wonderful, and occasionally remembered to put flea medicine on him. Michael gave it some thought.
Okay. I never told you that Bob Adams got a divorce.
A colleague from work she barely knew. You're right. That's not all that interesting.
Why? His wife left him for her cats. Apparently she wasn't satisfied with the 6 she had and wanted number 7. He put his foot down and said it was him or the cats, and she chose Pussytown. Either he grossly miscalculated and is broken-hearted, or he won the war by losing the battle. He certainly didn't seem all that sad about it.
I bet his new place will be much less fluffy, Frances said.
Oh, he kept the house. She took the cats and moved into a cat-positive commune in Northern California. When I said Pussytown, I meant Pussytown. That's what it's called.
Lally reappeared. I'm ready now. You can read to me now.
Okay. Frances got up and looked over at Michael. If that is your idea of a boring secret, I want to hear all of them.
No, the whole point of secrets is keeping them. And none of them has anything like the human interest or feline backstory that that one did.
I'll be the judge of that. That one was genuinely weird. I would have told you and about 8 other people that story.
Can I be the judge?
Lally took Frances by the hand, looking up at her. Frances grinned at her. Sure, baby.
What is a judge?
Someone who decides things other people can't agree on. Time for bed, okay? Lally went to hug her dad. He pulled her onto his lap and snortled in her ear, making her laugh. She curled up and giggled, and for about the 900th time, Frances wished she were small enough to curl up on some big person's lap and be completely safe. 7. Down the street, Anne was getting ready for bed. Outside the bathroom door, she could hear Kate and Charlie laughing, as Kate explained something arcane about Pokemon, and Charlie pretended to get everybody's name wrong.
Isn't that what Pikachu does? He said,
causing Kate to click her tongue in amused irritation.
Isn't Claptrap a chocolate type? Or is it a popcorn type with attacks like Salty Pop and Deadly Kernel?
Kate burst into giggles.
Daddy, there is no such thing as a popcorn type, and you know that. You watched the show with me this morning before school.
Was that what that was?
Charlie sounded incredulous.
I thought that was an educational show about Japanese animals.
They're made up.
They are?
Anne used to find these exchanges endlessly touching. She'd fallen in love with Charlie for his whimsy, as much as his charming good looks. He seemed like a proper grown-up on the outside, well-dressed, whip-smart, a successful patent attorney and partner in his firm. But he was secretly about 9 years old and still found farts, slipping on things, and silly hats hilarious. He loved to play with the kids, which was good because Anne had always had a hard time relaxing enough to enjoy it. She had found having small children utterly terrifying, convinced they were going to choke to death on something or drown in the bathtub or spontaneously develop dengue fever. Now that they were bigger and a little more robust, she could relax more. But she still found herself contemplating their loss far more than she would have liked. The affair had proved to be an effective antidote to fear, which was unexpected and, of course, ironic. When she found herself thinking about the pain of losing her children,
The fear of making a mistake that led to their harm. The overwhelming sense of misplaced responsibility. She would just think about Richard. Think about his hands, his hair, his eyes, his desire. And let the physical arousal she felt blow right through her panic. She knew where she was with him. She was being naughty. She was being selfish. She was risking it all. And it confirmed her secret belief that she was a very bad person who never should have been given children in the first place. She washed her face carefully, mixing water with some special cleansing grain she bought at the one store that carried them, the scent of roses and chalk signaling the end of the day. She enjoyed the feeling of them under her fingers, the way they held their hard edges in the water for a moment before succumbing and blooming into solution. She rinsed her face, looking for stray molecules of clay with her eyes closed, the contours of her face reassuring her. Still alive, then. Toner, again with the scent of roses, then moisturizer, firm strokes up her throat. She felt a tiny sore spot and tipped her head, the merest hint of beard burn, right under the edge of her jawline. She looked at it coldly. Why couldn't young men shave properly? Then pulled her heavy, pale pink dressing gown from its hook and went to help Charlie with the kids. Charlie looked at his wife as she came out of the bathroom, bringing the scent of roses with her, the smell he associated with her, and with her being his. He loved this Anne, the one that emerged without a scrap of makeup, without her elegant outfits and cool eyes, her pauses in conversation, her judgment. She was wearing the cashmere and satin dressing gown he'd bought her for Valentine's Day the previous year, the cost of which had made him pause for a moment, before the memory of her skin against his blew his reservations away. He thought of this as the real Anne, the one that only he knew. Her eyes met his, and they both smiled. "Are you ready for bed, Pumpkin?" she asked Kate, who ignored her and snuggled into her dad. He shrugged over her head, and Anne went to see what Theo was up to. Unsurprisingly, he was on his computer, playing Minecraft. She sat on his bed, making a small stack of paperbacks slither to the floor. There were irregular thuds on the rug, reminding her suddenly of the sound of apples dropping at night, back when she was a child in Yakima County. Her children's childhood was so different from hers. She wondered what sounds would pull them back. Sirens and helicopters were their nightingales and falling fruit. She asked her son what he was building. Theo looked at her with bright eyes, happy to tell her about it.
"A fortress right now, but I just finished the gardens. Do you want to see?"
"Sure." Anne didn't really understand Minecraft, but she loved it when the kids shared their ideas and projects with her. Her own mother had never been in the least bit interested in sharing her thoughts with her children, and their opinion was utterly irrelevant to her. She'd expected them to love her and follow her instructions, and they did. It never occurred to her they might want more, and they had given up waiting for more to be offered. Maybe she'd had nothing to give. Theo navigated through the half-finished structure he was building and outside, coasting above what were apparently acres of farmland. There were serried rows of plants, separated by mere pixels, fields of digital corduroy. Theo was listening.
"Carrots, wheat, sunflowers, potatoes, and over here we have chickens, cows, and ocelots."
Anne raised her eyebrows.
"Ocelots?"
He shrugged.
"I like them."
She smiled. "Who doesn't?" She stood up. "It's time to get off now, though, and go to sleep." He looked at her, surprised.
"But I still have homework."
"You're supposed to do it before you go online, you know that." Her stomach sank. She didn't have time to get angry now. "How much do you have?" Theo looked worried and pulled his backpack closer across the floor.
"I don't know. Sorry, Mom. I only meant to go on for 10 minutes after dinner and lost track of time."
His mom said nothing, and he found his homework quickly.
"A math sheet and a chapter to read."
He looked up at her hopefully. That's not too bad, right?
Anne sighed. Okay. No computer tomorrow at all. You have to do homework first, okay?
She walked out, saying over her shoulder, Get ready for bed now. We'll read the chapter together and you can do the math sheet in the morning before school. It's too late to do it now. You need to get some sleep.
Behind her, Theo's eyes cleared. His mom always knew what to do. She was as reliable as the sun. If he was naughty, she would issue a consequence. If he was good, she would issue a reward. And if he needed a hug, her arms would already be open. He was by nature a worried child, concerned about unseen dangers, worried that somehow he had messed things up. His mom never seemed to worry, and she was the trellis his little vines twined around. She walked back into her bedroom, where Kate was drifting off to sleep next to Charlie, who was on his phone and paying no attention. He looked up as Anne came in and raised his eyebrows in a question, indicating their daughter. Keeping her voice low, Anne said, You keep her. I'll deal with Theo, then sleep in her room, okay? Anne and Charlie slept in the same bed maybe twice a week, moving from bed to bed as their children dictated. Both of them would rather sleep than get a chance to be intimate with each other. Charlie, at least, was glad his libido seemed to have gone into hibernation. As a younger man, it would have killed him to be next to Anne but not able to reach out for her in the night, tugging at her nightgown until she woke up and came to him. But now he loved the gentle sounds of a sleeping child, the occasional foot in the face, a small price to pay for the feeling of being a family. Sometimes he would wake in the night and walk from room to room, counting his blessings as they slept. He nodded at his wife and blew her a kiss, which Anne pretended to catch and pressed to her lips, tossing him one in return. He turned out the light, pulled the sheet over Kate, who was now gently snoring, and went back to checking email on his phone. Iris sat on the edge of Wyatt's bed and watched him breathe, his face smoothed out in sleep, his cheeks flushed. How could eyelids so small lift lashes so long? He held Gubby in his hand, a small rabbit that had once been soft and gray, but was now worn and torn, the cream feet and ears more like gray, the gray more like brown.
When I die, he had once asked, will Gubby die with me?
Iris had nodded, taking the question at face value and trying not to let him see how the thought made her feel. She prayed he'd die about 8 decades after he'd forgotten Gubby, or more, maybe breaking the world record for longevity, oldest man ever. Sarah coughed gently at the door and held out her hand. Iris smiled and got to her feet, after tucking the sheet more fully around Wyatt. She held her wife's hand as they walked down the hall toward their bedroom. Sarah was looking at her in a way that meant she wanted to fool around, and Iris was wondering if she could ask her, afterward, if another baby were possible. That's what it was doing to her, this longing. Everything was related to it somehow. Every breath, every kiss, every bite of nutritious food. Every baby smiled at in the grocery store was a wish for another. She was going mad, and the madness was coloring everything. She and Sarah had a good marriage, a strong friendship, yet Iris was worried her request for another child would sound like a demand. What if Sarah said, it's me or a baby? And why did Iris even think that was a possibility? Sarah was never like that, had never been like that. Iris was losing her fucking mind. Lucas slept horizontally, like a stave. He had fallen asleep in his parents' bed, and pretty much stretched from one side to the other. Bill had slowly moved to the very edge of the bed to make room. He folded one leg down to stop himself sliding off, and to help him balance the computer on his lap. The lights were off, and he was miles away, immersed in the music he was composing. As his heart slept beside him in superhero pajamas, Bill fought dragons one phrase at a time, and didn't think of his wife at all. 8. Francis tapped the horn.
Lucas was supposed to be running down the slight slope of his front yard right now. Actually, several minutes ago. She sighed, turned to Ava, and opened her mouth.
No, honk again. Louder.
Her daughter's tone was cool, but her eyes were ready to start a fight. Frances raised her eyebrows. Ava was working on her passive resistance this morning, and had been ever since Frances had dared to suggest that something with sleeves might be a good idea.
"Here he comes,"
said Lally from behind her, saving Frances from another bout with the standing featherweight champion of in-car boxing.
"Sorry, Frances."
Bill had come with his son and stood next to the car as Lucas clambered in.
"I overslept. Danny didn't want to get dressed, and it took a while to compromise."
Frances looked in the rearview. Lucas was wearing pajama pants, but a regular t-shirt. She smiled at Bill.
"Looks like a perfect outfit to me," she said. "He's covered, right?"
Bill smiled back, thinking for the 100th time how much he liked Frances. She was easy, Frances was. No muss, no fuss. Just us humans here, no need to panic. Frances smiled at him, put the car back into gear, and got ready to pull away.
"See you later, Bill."
She waved as she headed down the street, and Bill raised his hand in return. Frances looked at him in the side mirror, still waving after her as she reached the end of the block. As she swung around the corner, he swiveled on his heel just as smoothly, and went back into the house. She wondered anew where Julie was. Once Lally and Lucas had started at the same preschool, she and Julie had begun a tentative friendship, but then suddenly Julie wasn't at home anymore. She'd asked Bill if Julie was away for work, and Bill had just shaken his head and said nothing. That had been a couple of months ago, and somehow the moment for inquiry had passed. She and Iris had joked that maybe Bill killed his wife and buried her in the yard, but she'd heard Lucas talking about his mom to Lally, so presumably that wasn't true. It was strange, and the neighborhood gossips had tried Julie in absentia and found her guilty of abandonment with a side order of failing to keep them all informed. Frances hadn't known her well enough to have her phone number, and certainly didn't know Bill well enough to ask where he'd stashed his wife. Frances mentally shrugged her shoulders and focused again on the road. People did weird shit, usually for boring reasons, and Frances tried not to judge people without knowing all the facts. She flashed on Anne's face, her eyes closed with pleasure as her boyfriend's tongue teased and pleased, and found it all too easy to judge and sentence that one. After dropping off the smallest kids, Frances circled back to the high school. She sat there with her windows down and the radio on quietly, waiting to hear the first bell. Frances had an appointment to talk to the school counselor about Ava's grades. They'd argued about it the previous night.
"My grades are fine," Ava had insisted. "A solid B is totally okay. Why are you so focused on achievement? Aren't we supposed to be embracing a growth mindset these days?"
She'd been sitting on her bed, her long legs and stripy tights folded up under her, one side of her hair shaved, the other streaked with purple. She was the cool kid Frances had always wanted to be friends with at school, but now Frances understood that the independence she'd admired had come at a price at home. The coolest girl at her school, 6 million years previously, had brought a pet rat to school every day, hidden somewhere on her person. At the time, it had seemed bold and daring, a declaration, a manifesto. Now it struck Frances that the rat must have represented a daily argument with her mother that only got her revved up for the potential half-dozen others she would have once she got the rat to school. Frances wondered what had happened to that girl. The rat was dead, of course, time being what it was. To be honest, Frances admired the way Ava was starting to bring serious artillery to these discussions, reinforcing her arguments with actual information and well-researched ideas. Frances thought she spent too much time online, but it was clear she wasn't just watching cat videos. Ava often regaled her mother with facts Frances didn't know, sometimes casually, sometimes with enormous excitement.
She had almost weekly obsessions, her future plans changing accordingly. She was going to restore old houses. She was going to breed rare lizards. She was going to be a psychologist. She was going to be president. She was going to move to Ireland, Iceland, New Zealand, New York. Everyone loved to warn you about teenagers, particularly teenage girls. They'd raise their eyebrows as they watched your four-year-old cartwheeling about. Oh, wait till they're teenagers, then the trouble starts. Or something equally dark. Sure, Ava gave her way more attitude than she had at seven. But she also came to her full of enthusiasm about things Frances had never heard of, and asked her questions about morals and metaphysics. Frances had privately decided the world just didn't like teenagers to have fun, or to be enthusiastic and confident, so they told everyone teens needed squashing or fearing. It was the same old bullshit, and ignored the thrilling excitement of watching your child's world open up in front of them, unfurling like the yellow brick road, the emerald spires of adulthood a distant, shimmering dream. Anything was possible. They could do and be anything. They could try on 18 different personalities a month. Frances believed in Ava and held on tight, even as her daughter bucked and bitched and tried to throw her off. The bell rang, and after waiting a few minutes for the kids to mill to their various rooms, Frances stepped out of the car. She believed in her kid. But that didn't mean she didn't need to go talk to the counselor. Trust, but verify. The counselor's name was Jennifer, and she was approximately half Frances's age. She had been born perky, but had also refined her natural talents through years of pep rallies and cheer squad at school, and was now pert and energetic enough to jumpstart a tractor trailer. "Your daughter's doing great," she said, her eyes strafing across Ava's file. "Her teachers love her. She appears relatively popular. The nurse hasn't seen her all semester." Her eyes narrowed slightly. "Although, she has dropped all her extracurriculars. Did you know that?" Frances didn't. "Like what? The school paper?" Jennifer nodded. "Yeah, she quit that. And the orchestra. She used to go to animation club once a week, and she quit that too." Her eyes lifted to meet Frances's. The poster behind her urged everyone not to eat the marshmallow, which was making Frances hungry. She thought back. Ava had definitely stayed later at school the week before for orchestra practice. What the actual fuck? "Well, could she just need more time for her schoolwork? I'm concerned that her grades are slipping a bit." Jennifer smiled. "Grades aren't the only metric we look at here, as you know. They are only one of many indicators of success." Frances hated it when neonates lectured her about things she already understood. Youth-splaining. But outwardly she smiled. "I understand that, Jennifer. But last year she got A's in English and art, for example, and this year she hasn't gotten above a B. I just wanted to check in to make sure you aren't aware of any problems here I might have missed." Jennifer looked back at the file and lifted a piece of paper. A post-it caught her attention. "How are things with Piper these days?" Frances was surprised. "Who's Piper?" It was Jennifer's turn to be surprised. "Piper is a new student who arrived from New York over the summer. Ava hasn't mentioned her?" Frances shook her head. "Huh. Ava was assigned to be her buddy, you know, when Piper first got here. For the first month, they were inseparable, a great pair, a good match. Then something happened, and Piper and Ava stopped hanging out overnight." Frances frowned. "Well, couldn't that be natural? You know, you get a buddy at a new job or whatever, and after a week or so you make your own connections and kind of stop hanging out with the buddy?" Jennifer was looking at her blankly, but Frances pushed on. "Have you read The Mezzanine by Nicholson Baker? He talks about it. He might even give that relationship a name. It's an awesome book." Now Jennifer was looking openly concerned,
so Frances trailed off and cleared her throat.
No, she said. Ava hasn't mentioned Piper at all.
Jennifer shrugged.
Well, that's the only thing her file mentions. That and the extracurriculars.
Are you seeing behavior at home that concerns you?
Frances shrugged back at her. No, just the usual crankiness and complaints that we don't give her a phone.
Jennifer was shocked. She doesn't have a phone?
Brief pause.
Pretty much every kid in ninth grade has a phone. What if she needs to call you?
Frances said, well, apparently she could borrow one of the many phones around her.
I can't believe every kid has a phone. They're very expensive, and that's not including the monthly bill.
Jennifer looked genuinely concerned.
No, really, they all do.
She got to her feet, the meeting apparently over.
I'm sorry, I have a staff meeting to go to.
She held out her hand.
Always a pleasure, Frances. You should consider getting Ava a phone, though. Not having one really singles her out.
Frances walked down the school hallway, perplexed. Had she missed a memo? Pencils, paper, textbooks, iPhone? Really? She looked up and realized she'd walked the wrong way out of Jennifer's office. A bell rang for the end of class, and suddenly the hall was filled with kids, as tall or taller than Frances. They all had backpacks large enough to support a 3-month exploration of Europe, and Frances was nearly knocked over several times before she managed to find a clear channel down the center of the hallway.
Mom?
Shit. She'd come face to face with Ava, who at first looked pleased to see her, then suspicious.
Is there something wrong? Is everyone okay? What are you doing here?
The other kids pushed around them, and Frances got a sudden mental image of the buffalo stampede in The Lion King. She really needed to spend less time with Disney.
Everyone's fine. I had to see Jennifer about something.
She looked at her daughter.
Is that eyeliner?
You came to see if I was wearing makeup?
No, I'm just asking a question. And while I'm asking that, is that lipstick?
Ava narrowed her eyes.
Seriously?
Frances took a breath.
Let's start over, okay?
Okay.
Hi, Ava. Funny meeting you here.
Not really. I'm here every day. You, however.
I'm here to see your counselor because I had some questions for her.
About me?
Of course. What other topic would we discuss?
Your secret desire to become a cheerleader?
Frances laughed. Busted.
Ava smiled. Then the bell rang again.
I have to go.
Mom, really, why are you here?
To spy on you. We can talk about it when I pick you up later, okay?
Frances went to hug her daughter, expecting to be rebuffed. But Ava hugged her back tightly.
I miss you when I'm at school,
she said quietly in Frances's ear.
Me too, her mom replied.
They let go of each other, and Ava put on a believable expression of unconcern.
See you later, Mom.
Frances nodded, and Ava walked off. After a moment, Frances turned to leave. So when Ava turned around to smile at her mother one more time, she only saw her back.
9. Driving away from school, Frances called Michael, putting the call on speaker.
Sup, dog?
His voice always cheered her up.
Do you have 5 minutes to chat?
She slowed to let an extremely slow old lady cross the street, causing the person behind her to honk his horn. She raised her hand in front of her driver's mirror, the middle finger extended. What was she supposed to do, run the woman down?
We're all getting old, asshole, she thought. It won't be long before it's you shuffling along and peeing anxiously into your adult diapers because some dick, who isn't brave enough to chivvy you face to face, is happy to lean on his horn. Fuck you, asshole.
The guy honked again, and she rolled down the window and extended her other hand.
tipped up palm, emphatic point at old person, middle finger. Frances knew that mime documentary she'd watched would come in handy one day. She tried to focus on her husband.
Yep, as long as it's 5 minutes. I have a meeting at 10.
He sounded busy but relaxed, which was pretty much his default state. Frances looked at her watch. 9:45.
Okay. I went to school to talk to Jennifer, the counselor.
Michael laughed.
And now you want to become a cheerleader?
Ava said the same thing.
What is it with you people?
The lady had reached the other side and stood there panting. Frances wondered what she thought about, whether she paid any attention to the world around her or just focused on making it across street after street. She suddenly hated the young guy behind her, and then, as he pulled past her and honked angrily one last time, saw he was a middle-aged woman like herself.
Ava was there too? Why didn't you have me come?
He sounded slightly less amused.
No, she wasn't there at the meeting. I ran into her in the hallway.
Busted. Was she mad?
Not really. Although she was wearing makeup that she hadn't been wearing when I dropped her off half an hour earlier. Frances wondered why this even mattered to her, why she was even mentioning it. Sometimes she was critical for no real reason she could discern, and didn't like it in herself. If it had been conscious, she could stop herself from doing it, but it seemed to come from nowhere. She'd heard somewhere that a sad portion of your thoughts are just society's opinions, disguised as inner monologue. A depressing thought. Or was that just society telling you it was a depressing thought? She was getting a headache.
Well, so? She is 14. A little makeup is a rebellion I can handle.
Michael sounded a little defensive. He paused and then said,
Unless we're talking full drag queen.
No. Eyeliner and lipstick. Michael, that is not the point. The point is that she's dropped all her extracurriculars without telling us.
School paper?
No, she quit. And orchestra. And animation club, which, to be honest, I didn't know she was doing, so the fact that she isn't doing it anymore isn't really a thing for me. Although it's a bit sad. Frances heard voices in the background and felt her husband getting distracted.
Are you listening?
No, he said honestly. Jason just came in and I have to go. Can you call me later? Let's talk about it before we talk to Ava, okay? She is allowed to have control over her own schedule, you know.
As was often the case, there was a warning note in his voice. When Frances had an issue with Ava, Michael often took Ava's side, protective of his child, which always irritated Frances. They were both on Ava's side, after all. But Michael wouldn't hear a word of criticism of his precious firstborn, or, indeed, any of the kids. He was their huntsman, and Frances was apparently the old lady with the apple. It pissed her off, and she felt her temper rising a little.
Sure, I'm sure whatever you're doing is more important than the kids.
Now, why was she baiting him? He was at work, after all. There was a pause. Michael had known her for 20 years, and proved it by replying,
Don't get stressed out about this, Frank. It's probably nothing, and we'll get to the bottom of it without World War III, okay?
He covered the phone and spoke to the guy in his office, then returned to her.
Go eat something, okay? You sound hungry. I'll talk to you soon.
They hung up, and Frances felt the usual combination of mollified and itchy for an argument. Sometimes one of them would pick a fight, and the other one would be up for it. But more often one of them would get pissy, and the other one would Aikido that shit immediately. She guessed that was the benefit of marriage, that you could tell what was real and what was just low blood sugar. So fucking irritating. Heading aimlessly home, pondering what to do about Ava, and how to approach it, unavoidable now that they had run into each other, the phone rang.
Hey!
Hey! It was her friend, Lily. Frances smiled, happy to hear the voice of someone who was completely on her side,
someone with whom she could bitch unfairly about her husband. Honestly, he could find a cure for cancer, and Lily would agree that he really should have washed out all those petri dishes.